second.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is March 17th, 2015. We're going to go out of order because some of the people who are here for 2901 have to get to another meeting. So we'll start with that. We may have to close that and reopen it because I have some people who said they would be a little bit late. We're going to accommodate some of the witnesses. I'm going to go ahead and do that first.
Okay. Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2901 is a committee bill. It creates the Privacy Protection and Safe Communities Act. The bill establishes a framework that regulates law enforcement's use of pen registers, trap and trace devices, electronic communication devices such as cell phones, data associated with electronic communication devices, and mobile tracking devices. There is no revenue impact. It may have a fiscal impact, but we don't know yet.
Okay, thank you. Rod Underhill, Chief Spaulding, and Jason Myers, Sheriff Myers, please.
John, can I come up?
Yes, you can.
Would you like me to hold it?
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and it's my pleasure to introduce this brief segment regarding House Bill 2901. Because of the incredible number of emerging technologies that are out there, some of which benefit law enforcement as tools and some of which we confront in our work to address criminal behavior, caused our association, the Chiefs Association's DA's Association, and others to put together a special group that's really designated and designed to address technology as it's emerging and how that might be integrated responsibly by law enforcement agencies. We were also confronting bills every session that tried to get a handle on how do we utilize properly new technologies in the policing environment. House Bill 2901 is a product from what we call the Law Enforcement Responsible Technology Work Group. It's a combination of leaders, experts in technology, experts in law enforcement, our members of our accreditation alliance, and experts in best policy and practice. Together, they have worked to try to craft legislation that helps to guide the implementation of new technologies on the part of law enforcement agencies. So the goals, and you'll see this in the testimony, so I'll be very brief regarding this. The first goal was to modernize statutes surrounding privacy. Our statutes are extremely antiquated, and while the courts continue to rule and to guide the way law enforcement utilizes and accesses private information, the statutes themselves are very old. They're out of date, and they have they're very poor with regard to how they address new technologies as they come along. So this Law Enforcement Responsibility Work Group was tasked for creating a modernization of the statutes. That's House Bill 2901. This group believes strongly that privacy rights and community safety are not mutually exclusive. They are not an either or, they are a both and. And I could say with confidence as I sat around the room with those law enforcement professionals, they believe and take their responsibility for upholding privacy rights because they are upholding the Constitution very seriously. And it's with that lens that they put together and worked on House Bill 2901. Second purpose was to really align agency policies because the legislature helps create the boundaries, but at the end of the day, it's agencies that have to develop best practice policies that help implement these on the ground in a responsible manner. So this Law Enforcement Responsible Technology Work Group is designed to align policies and to create what we call policy frameworks so that agencies of all sizes, regardless of where they exist in the state, can implement these policies with some flexibility, recognizing their differences, but while maintaining some very significant best practice guidelines. And then the final point is that, obviously, a policy alone is not sufficient. Training has to accompany that. The implementation of these policies is important. And probably most importantly, before deploying a new technology in a policing environment, all of those pieces have to be in place first. We don't deploy and then figure out how to train and then figure out what our policy is. It's the other way around. And I can say with confidence that this work of the Law Enforcement Responsible Technology Work Group has been very helpful. So we're really committed as our associations to partner with you and the legislative process to make sure laws are properly directing our work while giving us the opportunity to develop best practices. So we're implementing these two new technologies in a way that really benefit the public, maintain their privacy protections, and at the same time create the best opportunity for community safety. And so with that, I'm going to turn over to Sheriff Jason Myers.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm Marion County Sheriff and President of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Mr. Campbell has done a really good job of explaining the process by which we've gone through to put this bill before you together. It's been thoughtful and inclusive and has been between all three of the Sheriff's Association organization, the Chiefs Association, and the District Attorney's Association. Before I turn this over to District Attorney Rod Underhill to kind of go through the specifics of the bill, I'd like to call your attention to a sheet that we've included in your paperwork. It's a blue sheet, and it really illustrates the process by which the legal process that we must follow to access data and information. And when you get a moment as we're going through this bill to take a look at that, there is a process by which through the courts that we apply to get this kind of information when we're doing criminal investigations. And with that, I will turn it over to Rod Underhill.
Thank you. Chair Barker, thank you for having some willingness to accommodate certain schedules. I very much appreciate that. Vice Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Olson, thank you, and committee members. So as I listened to Mr. Campbell summarize the work group that we had put together, I'm not sure what category I fall into as far as people who participated, but I did join in that group and had numerous conversations with very interested members of your public safety community around the state. From my personal standpoint, I've been a prosecutor for 26 years. I'm the district attorney now of Multnomah County, and for approximately the first 20 years or 20-plus years, I was a boots-on-the-ground person who did this work, responding to crime scenes, going to numerous, almost at times it seems countless, homicide crime scenes, and literally working on the kind of area that we're talking about making modifications to. I've written wiretap applications that measure in the number of hundreds of pages, plural. I've written search warrants and participated in that are dozens and tip the scale of close to 100 pages. Those are, of course, some of the more unusual and more intensive cases. But all of these cases require a significant amount of rigor, serious work on behalf of law enforcement, both in the investigative stage and the prosecutor's role in these matters, and we take them very seriously. Now, House Bill 2901, the Privacy and Protection and Safe Communities Act, is law enforcement's plan, as you've heard, to modernize and enhance the privacy protections afforded to Oregonians while maintaining the tools that law enforcement needs to be able to do the job effectively in this digital age. Now, what tools does law enforcement need? I'll summarize some of those bullet points before we get into some of the deeper details. Like civil lawyers and administrative agencies, law enforcement needs the ability to use subpoenas to gather business records that companies create and maintain for their customers. Regarding subpoenas, it is important to remember that subpoenas are brought to and receive the authorization, once we obtain the records, authorization from grand jury members, so a vote of at least five of your citizens need to be obtained before we are allowed to use even subpoenaed record material in this area. We need to have the ability to apply for warrants, search warrants, in a reasonable way to access the more sensitive information, such as discovering a person's location or content of communication. We also need to be able to ensure that the process in place for obtaining and utilizing these records is consistent with best practices and not unduly burdensome on law enforcement. So what privacy protections do need modernization? We need to update the mobile tracking device statute that permits the tracking of a person's location through a device on their vehicle to ensure it applies to any form of electronic monitoring as well. Quite literally, what I'm talking about is we use and still do periodically the term bird dog. sometimes, with proper authorization, we will place a physical device on a car, for example. I've done it in homicide investigations with people that we suspected of committing murder and those kinds of offenses. We also, nowadays, because our statutes are antiquated, nowadays you've heard of the notion of electronically following people through their devices. We want to make sure our mobile tracking devices are updated and are caught up, and 2901 helps do that. And as I walk through this, is going to apply, I believe, a certain and satisfactory amount of rigor, judicial review and authorization before we ever do that. But I'll get back to that in a minute. We need to provide specific guidance on how long these records and types of records may be held by law enforcement if no crime is prosecuted. So what current law does House Bill 2901 help to enhance? So currently law enforcement needs to rely on a combination of our outdated statutory scheme together with federal law to provide the tools to obtain these types of cell phone records, for example. Federal law requires essentially a reasonable suspicion and a court order approved by a judge to obtain records held by a phone company. This would include historical and current location information. I use terms of art carefully, I hope, or I plan to, and I believe do. A court order is different than a search warrant. But we're here telling you that Oregon law enforcement has proactively been seeking in the recent past and wants to continue to seek full search warrants when we seek current and ongoing location information being sought. So these bird dogs, these devices on a motor vehicle, as well as our devices, our handheld devices and such that we carry around, federal law requires court order. We're agreeing, we have been and we agree that with through 2901 that that level of scrutiny should be through search warrant. Currently, subpoenas may be obtained by lawyers, criminal and civil, for business records held by third-party companies. We believe that this is appropriate and a correct standard for typical subscriber records held by the phone companies that do not disclose location, location information that I've already touched on. House Bill 2901 would codify this existing standard. Criminal procedures, criminal subpoenas, as I have touched on, are vetted by the grand jury, where the grand jury must approve the use of subpoenaed records. Currently, federal law provides for court orders based on reasonable suspicion for historical location. So historical, not ongoing, and that's a distinction I want to make sure that I make. But historical information does require a court order. We believe this is a best practice for historical information and would codify that practice in House Bill 2901 with enhanced protections above the current law by providing that the application for such records be supported by an affidavit from the law enforcement officer with certain specific criteria met. Currently, subpoenas for cell records are not filed with the court upon their completion. They are not filed with the court. This bill would ensure increased transparency by requiring that a subpoena be filed in a criminal case where the matter is being prosecuted. Currently, also, there is no time limitation on how long law enforcement may retain cell phone records when no prosecution commences. We believe that there should be a limit and that law enforcement should destroy the records once the statute of limitation for offenses under investigation has passed. So, in summary, just by way of example, typical felonies, but for outside exceptions, typical felonies have a 3-year statute of limitations. If we have a investigation for an assault one, absent special unique circumstances don't even occur to me as I sit here, that would be your statute of limitations. And if we have, pursuant to our investigation, not been able to bring criminal charges in that 3-year window of time, those records should and will be destroyed based on our House Bill 2901. Now, walking through some of the specific sections. Section 2 updates the pen register statute to ensure it covers modern practices. The current statute only applies to physical devices installed in hardware to intercept the dialed numbers of a phone when making phone calls. Modern practices, however, use software processes in order to obtain this result. This definitional change will ensure that citizens enjoy the same protection under pen register statute when law enforcement uses this modern technology. Section 4 updates the pen register statute to provide a limited list of reasonable exceptions to the need to obtain a court order. So exceptions to obtain the need to obtain a court order relative to pen register device. these exceptions would include the exigent circumstances.
Question.
Yes.
You bet.
I notice here some language is common but different across different parts of the statute. And this issue about exigent, at this point it talks about you don't need to have a warrant. Make sure I get this right. You don't need to have a warrant or a court order under the following circumstances. In other places, it says a warrant or a court order or a subpoena under specific services. But then it has a definite, I think it's a definition of exigent, and that's what I want to ask you. It says exigent services exist, comma, the law enforcement agency has probable cause to believe. Ongoing. Later it says exigent in a different section under the same kind of thing. It talks about exigent circumstances and these things. So my question is, what's exigent circumstances and how does it apply with regard to the rest of the phrase? It's written differently in at least two different places.
I'll try to catch up on where you're referring to in the two different places. But relative to exigent circumstances is a difficult thing to sit here and list all of the examples. They are found throughout bodies of decades and decades of case law in our, in the Oregon jurisprudence and the nation's jurisprudence. They deal with circumstances that have a degree of urgency and oftentimes an extremely high degree of urgency. We can think of those examples, but if I created a list of 100 things, I'm going to have left off 100. I'm going to have left off 200. They deal with situations that we don't expect to encounter yet do. An unhealthy child, anything unpredictable dealing with the health of an individual and a circumstance that occurs. When you have law enforcement may respond to a situation where you have what appears to be a drug overdose and a perception that there is a sense of
this
urgency.
Says exigent services, circumstances, comma, and a bunch of other things. So does it mean...
Representative, can you point to where you're referring to?
Well, let's start with page 2, line 26. I'll show you the next one if you want. But this is talking about a pen registry or trap and trace device.
Correct.
When you can do that without a subpoena or, although it doesn't mention subpoena here.
Warrant.
Later it does talk about subpoena where it says a warrant or a court order. The next section I'll show you, it says a subpoena, a warrant or a court order. But it then, I could read that to say with those comma, it doesn't say exigent circumstance and, which it does in the next section. So does that mean here that you can do a pen in a pen registry when you believe a crime is committed, even without there being exigent circumstances?
No, that's not what that's intended to say.
So it should say and, as it does in the next section?
Well, I need to really apologize because I'm not completely tracking with what you're saying, but I am very clear when I said no, we are not looking to be able to seek and install, if you will, or affect the process of a pen register or trap and trace without a search warrant, without a warrant or court order, absent one of the lists of what you see is 1 through 6.
The next circumstance is in section 6, and line 31, where it says
page 3, line 31.
That's page 3. It says here it says a warrant, court order, and subpoena. Does that mean you can use a subpoena in the other one, but not here? But,
no.
But then it says exigent and these other things happen.
Well, so,
there be a difference between those two definitions?
There is, because you have to back up to the paragraph before of what we're referring to, Representative. So on page 3, line 28, section 2 there, a law enforcement agency may obtain the subscriber information, transactional information, historical location data, or personal electronic data of an electronic communication device without a warrant, court order, or subpoena under the following circumstances. But what it's referring to as subscriber information, let me focus on that term of art. So subscriber information, this bill, and it is also true for today, allows for subpoena to be used. You don't need a search warrant. You don't need a court order.
My question is much simpler. My question is, when you say exigent circumstances, comma, is that different than saying exigent services and, which is clear in that case, it means both exigent circumstances and the belief that a crime is committed.
In one place it says and, and in the other it's just a comma.
Maybe we could just, yeah, I mean, this just may be an error in drafting.
Oh, I see in on page 2, section 1, exigent circumstances exist, comma,
yes,
the law enforcement agency, and then in page 3, line 31, exigent circumstances exist and law enforcement.
Which makes it clear they're linked in the first case, it doesn't.
Representative, I have to apologize. I don't know if that is a kind of a Scrivener's error.
Take a look.
Or something that
I'm like a lawyer here. I'm very careful.
Yeah.
That's
so bad.
Mr. Chair, I have one question along the same lines.
Sure.
Page 2, line 27, probable cause to believe a crime punishable as a felony for the pen register and trap and trace device, and I don't see that in the other sections of the bill.
Is it here? On three?
And I'm just wondering if that, if there's a reason it's included in that one and not the other ones. Unless I'm missing it on the other ones. But.
I see it where. Well, maybe it's me. Again, I apologize for being a little jumbled. But if I'm looking at the right place, I'm looking at page 2, what I call section 4.1, and the definition of exigent circumstance exists, and it refers to that punishable as a felony has occurred. All right? I then flip to page 3, line, what would be 32,
I see it there again.
Like,
okay. I said, it could just be me missing it. Just fine.
And then just by way of, I'm aware that it also refers to that same language, a crime punishable as a felony, back in the modifications to the mobile tracking device section. So specifically what I'm referring to is page 5 now.
Okay.
Line 26.
And I guess I would just, as a follow-up question, is that to, is that a limiting factor? Is that why it's in?
It is.
Okay.
Yep. Specifically, by way of just example, I guess, maybe a helpful example, I hope. In the bird dog statute, currently there is a finite list of felonies, not punishable as a felony, but instead a finite list of certain felonies. And so it is attempting to be intentional language that is limiting in one respect, but in the bird dog area, it would be expanding.
Okay.
But we believe appropriately so. Moving on to sections 5 and 6, to summarize, and I'll, of course, if there are questions, feel free, but I'll go on for another minute or two here. Sections 5 and 6 create a new statute that governs obtaining records from cell phone companies. It ensures that no user content may be obtained without a search warrant. No historical location information may be obtained without a court order supported by reasonable suspicion, and no subscriber information is obtained without a valid subpoena. It creates limited, reasonable exceptions to these requirements, for example, exigent circumstances, which we've touched on, lost or stolen devices, consent, request for emergency services, and to assist in locating missing, endangered, or deceased individuals. Section 7 spells out the specific information that must be contained in a law enforcement officer's affidavit in order to obtain historical location information through that court order that we've talked about. This includes the identity, if known, of the subscriber, facts supporting the reasonable suspicion that a crime or crimes have occurred, and how the records sought will assist in the investigation. Section 9 updates the mobile tracking statute, as I've touched on. It broadens the language, as I mentioned to you, Vice Chair Williamson, and ensures that monitoring of information that provides the current location of a person is covered, and modernizes the modern tracking device statute to bring it in line with other statutes covering surveillance. This will ensure that law enforcement can not only utilize this information in certain felony crimes and certain misdemeanor offenses, and that the legislature has, which relative to the misdemeanors, the legislature has already approved certain authorized misdemeanors in previous sessions. It creates the same consistent list of sessions to that warrant, exceptions to the warrant requirement, such as we've touched on, consent, a request for emergency circumstances or services, I mean, stolen device, or to assist in finding missing, endangered, or deceased persons. So thank you very much for your time. I want to once again offer up if there are any questions that I can help with. I apologize, Representative Greenlick, for not having a complete handle on things, but we'll look into trying to discern what we've got relative to that and get back to you if that's all right.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Bill Meyer and Dave, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, testifying here with concerns about House Bill 2901, opposition, and requesting your very careful scrutiny. There's competing visions here in this bill with bills that had been introduced over on the Senate side, which were being heard this morning over on the Senate. Those bills were very much aware of the amassment of data, metadata, as well as content data that is sought to be amassed by the federal government and shared with state government, amassed by state government and shared with federal government, and how valuable of a commodity it is for law enforcement to be acquiring historical data of people's locations, people's communications, and people's whereabouts. I say this respectfully, but I say this genuinely. I would urge this committee to be cautious of this bill. It has the potential to sort of be a Patriot Act kind of bill. And what I say when I mean that, it changes statutory provisions that have been on our books for a long time and have been working well. It does expand government's ability to acquire and amass historical data. It was written without input, really, of competing stakeholders. Definitely was driven by law enforcement interests, for law enforcement interests. And similarly, we would caution this committee against endorsing any part of it without robust discussion and very careful scrutiny that you really do understand everything that this bill does. By way of example, Section 2 deals with pen registers and trap and trace devices. We don't have to go very far except to look up into Pierce County and Tacoma, Washington. It turns out that judges in Tacoma, Washington had been signing what they thought were typical true blue pen register trap and trace search warrant affidavits because they understood that law enforcement was looking for the exact communications on a particular cell phone to and from different people, and they wanted to amass who was the cell phone talking to and who was it receiving calls from. That's what a pen register and a trap and trace device can do. What was not shared with the judges in those search warrant affidavits is what the police were seeking to employ was the Stingray device. And if you haven't heard of what the Stingray device is, it will alarm you to realize that what it is it's basically a cell phone simulator. What it is, it can be imposed on a stationary post, but it's also more frequently put on police vehicles. And it basically tricks cell phones into thinking that that device is a cell tower. So whereas most a Verizon's cell phone might go to the Verizon tower and an AT&T phone might go to an AT&T tower, what the Stingray does is it pirates all of those cell phones within an area, and it goes through that Stingray device, and then that device then transports it back to the other relevant towers. In the course of doing that, they can essentially capture a particular phone number, identification number that they're looking for, and it can start to record now text messages, not just who the recipients of calls and this and who they're delivering their messages to, but also precise exact locations. And so as law enforcement is driving around with the Stingray, they are amassing data, not just on the one person for whom they sought the trap and trace pen register authorization, but on all of the other innocent cell phone users within the capture area of that Stingray. The scary thing about the Stingray is that it's being deployed, and it's being deployed here in Oregon by state and by municipalities and counties. It really is being operated outside of the scope of review of any branch of government. The agencies acquire the use of the Stingray through grants through federal DOJ. Sometimes it's through Homeland Security. But they don't have to actually purchase the machines generally, and so there's very rarely ever an expenditure of any public funds for the purposes of getting the device. So you don't have governing political elected bodies like city councils or county commissioners authorizing the use of the deployment of this device. And it's also outside of the purview of the judicial branch, because as a condition of acquiring or using these Stingrays, the agencies have to sign non-disclosure agreements. And so, therefore, they don't disclose the use of them in any search warrant affidavit. And so if they've acquired the objective fact that a defendant was in a particular house at a particular time, they don't ever disclose that the way in which they found that out was by and through the use of the Stingray. So what happened up in Tacoma was somehow it became known that in the course of signing these pen register and trap and trace affidavits, authorizations for pen trap and trace searches, they did not understand that what the law enforcement agencies were doing was then going out and capturing that information by and through the Stingray, which then acquired the information of all the other innocent users. So that is by way of example to suggest that we are truly in a new era. And this bill comes to you with an effort to expand. The proponents are saying modernize. We will simply say expand. Government's ability to amass historical data on innocent people as well as those upon whom they would set their eyes at the outset. There are changes in the standards that are being employed. So, for instance, and again, here's just another, this is a very dense bill, so I'm only going to give you perhaps little representative comments that show you how delicate this can be. The current trap and trace and pen register laws only allow use of those devices pursuant to an order that contains probable cause to believe that an individual is committing, has committing, or is about to commit a particular felony of murder, kidnapping, arson, robbery, bribery, extortion, or other crime dangerous to life and punishable as a felony, or a crime punishable as a felony under ORS 475 point whatever, which are basically our drug laws. This would expand that. If you look at Section 4, line 27, it basically says, well, we can install a pen register, a trap and trace device without a warrant or a court order if there's exigent circumstances that we have probable cause to believe that that a crime punishable as a felony has occurred. So what they're essentially saying is forget the limiter of a particularly dangerous felony. If we have probable cause and if there's what the law might consider exigent circumstances, boom, we just don't need any judicial oversight at all. So that's just an example of where this is being expanded. If you look on page 3, the definition of subscriber information, which is new, it's a new definition of subscriber information. It means information stored by an electronic communications service provider containing the name and the address of the subscriber. Now, that's generally what you think of when you think of subscriber information. So if someone wanted to get Eric Dietrich's subscriber information at Verizon, they would want to know, okay, you know, what's your account number and what's your name? I mean, what's your name and what's your address associated with this particular account number? But the definition here goes on. It says, in addition to the name and the address, it includes local and long-distance telephone connection records, records of session times, meaning how long you've been talking, the duration of the calls, the length of service, how long you've been a client, and types of services utilized, like Comcast, telephone or instrument number or other subscriber number or identity, including any temporary permanently assigned network or internet protocol addresses, and the sources and the means of payment for such services. So now they get to know where you bank. Now, if you go down, it says on line 28, a law enforcement agency may obtain the subscriber information without a warrant, court order, or subpoena under the following circumstances. Then again, it lists it. Exigent circumstances to believe that a crime is committed for which they have probable cause. So this really, truly is a really large expansion on current limitations that this body, the legislature, has enacted and have been living with for quite some time. I believe that Mr. Fedenke here, on behalf of the ACLU, will be talking about the importance of historical data and the amassment that's attempted to go on here through law enforcement, both at the federal and the state level. But if you look at Section 7 on page 4, it authorizes an ex parte order to obtain the historical location data, subscriber information, or transactional information with just an ex parte order. And again, that order would be issued on reasonable suspicion as opposed to probable cause. And it wouldn't have to be on the showing that it would yield evidence relevant to a crime. It could be issued on only an assertion that the information sought will assist in the investigation of a crime or crimes. So now they're simply looking at historical data that will simply assist us in looking for any felony, any crime, based on reasonable suspicion. Once they acquire that data, you have to ask yourself, how long will they, you know, to what other uses will they put it? We would ask the committee to recognize that this really is a huge paradigm shift in how it is we've treated sensitive subscriber information, location tracking information, and recognize that this is a huge reduction in privacy protections that we've enjoyed for years, and we'd ask the committee to exercise great caution. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, David Fedenke, Executive Director of the ACLU of Oregon, appearing in opposition to House Bill 2901. I believe staff has distributed to you two documents. One is a New York Times story that appeared just yesterday related to Stingray devices and in particular the non-disclosure agreements that have been required by the manufacturers and the federal agencies that have made the funds available for state and local jurisdictions to acquire these cell phone tower simulators. Gail has laid out for you very, very clearly, I think, what these devices are capable of and why they impose on the privacy rights of innocent people who are in the location of these areas. The second document goes to the definition of subscriber information and some of the practices that are going on currently at the federal level in compliance with federal law, which is incredibly outdated. This diagram that we distributed to you is a graphic representation of the to from information in emails that were sent or received by former ACLU Legislative Director Becky Strauss over an 8-year period. There is a service that's available on the MIT website that was put together by some grad students at MIT. If you give them permission, you can go there, log in, and give them approval to access your Gmail account or your Yahoo Mail account. And they will look at just the metadata and not even all of the metadata. Under federal law, based on a request from a federal official without any court supervision, federal agencies can get access to this to-from information, time of day, length of the message, and other types of information, including the subject line. Now, this graphic does not include subjects, but it does include to and from messages. The larger blobs are the people that Becky communicated with most often. And where those blobs overlap are the intersections of groups that she is connected to. And she was able to get a printout of this with names attached, addresses attached to each of the blobs. This is the kind of analysis that once you have access to metadata, any individual can accomplish. It reveals a tremendous amount of private information about an individual. And when government can get access to this information without probable cause that you have done anything wrong, we believe your privacy rights have been violated. And so we are arguing that these types of requests should be subject to a court order, court supervision, and a probable cause requirement. I think Gail has addressed the large expansion that this represents in terms of the crimes that would be swept into this that are not currently part of the statute. For those of you who haven't been around this process for very long, you may not be aware that that is something that law enforcement has sought for more than one decade and probably more than two decades. And this legislature, in its wisdom, has repeatedly said, no, we only want felony crimes where a person's life or serious physical injury may be involved before these kinds of orders could be granted, or in drug investigations. Drug investigations were added later. But I can guarantee you that if you approve this bill in its current form, this would not be the end of the request to expand it further. That definition of subscriber information that Gail pointed you to on page 3, which applies, I believe, to the other sections of the bill, includes, as she noted, you got to remember these laws were written at a time when we had landlines only. Cell phones didn't exist, the internet didn't exist, and when Congress created its laws addressing these issues, those devices did not exist. And we have been trying for years now to get Congress to revisit some of these issues in terms of protecting people's privacy given new technologies. You have an opportunity this session to set the correct standards for access to this kind of private information, and we hope you will set the bar much higher than what House Bill 2901 would have you do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate both of you sharing that. And I understand, I mean, you get exigent circumstances. I mean, I get that. I'm trying to kind of figure out how Section 6 and 7 tie into that, because it seems like it's kind of woven into this as well for me, for the accountability side of it, for needing to seek, you know, judicial assistance. So I'm just trying to kind of roll that all in with what you both said.
Representative Olson, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we believe that under current law, a warrant is already required to get access to any of this information. There's no question that because the law was written before the existence of current technology, there is some question about whether newer technologies are included. And we're supportive of clarifying the current statutes to make explicit that it includes all technologies. But we are opposed to expanding the types of information that could be accessed or lowering the bar in terms of the standard of evidence that would be required in order to get access to that information.
Okay.
Is that clear?
Thank you. Further questions, anybody? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2901. We have open an information meeting with friends at the Oregon State Hospital. Mr. Roberts, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Olson. For the record, I'm Greg Roberts. I'm the Superintendent of Oregon State Hospital, and I'm here to present information on the Aid and Assist, or 370, population at the hospital. To begin, patients are often referred to at the hospital, as I've said, 370 patients. It refers to the Oregon Statute 161.370, where court orders send a defendant for mental health treatment to the state hospital so that they can be restored to competency and restored to the ability to aid and assist in their own defense. So these, sorry.
Yeah. Well, I can't see it, so.
You can go sit by me.
So come join me.
So basically, someone is commits an act in the community. It may be a serious crime. It may be a minor offense, but they are evaluated as being unable to aid and assist in their own defense, and so they're sent to the state hospital for restoration of those services. The treatment that we provide these services is not the full gamut of services available at the state hospital. The focus is solely on the restoration of the ability to aid and assist. So the primary treatment goals are stabilization of the psychiatric condition. The goal is to, as has been said, to restore the ability to cooperate with attorneys and participate in their own defense. The treatment services are provided in our treatment malls by our treatment teams and focus on legal education, learning about the legal system, the role of the courts, the charges that the patient is facing. The outcome of the evaluations, there are three possible outcomes. So the first is that the person is able to aid and assist their defense. So at that point, the person is judged to be competent, and they are sent back to jail to proceed through the judicial system. Or the person is adjudicated as evaluated as not yet able, which indicates we believe the person can be restored to competency, restored to the ability to aid and assist, but they're not they're not at that point at the point in time that the report is filed with court, and that person continues to be treated at the state hospital. Then the third option is that the person is evaluated as never able, indicating we believe the person will never be able, is very unlikely to regain competency in the foreseeable future. And in that case, the person is also returned to jail, and the court either dismisses the charges against that person or orders a civil commitment proceeding. And if the person then is evaluated as meeting the requirements of the involuntary commitment law, then the person would come back to the state hospital as a civil commitment. And I can add there that very few do. I think only about 12% of people who are found never able to aid and assist do return to the state hospital as a civil commitment. The issue is always for all patients, including these patients, to make sure that people receive the right care in the right place at the right time, and to make sure that only people who require hospital-level services come to the state hospital. And that involves connecting people with services in their own community. Back in 2011, House Bill 3100 was approved and gave courts the flexibility to determine where people would be treated when they're accused of a nonviolent crime. It gave the courts the option to commit people to the state hospital, but only if they were judged to be a danger to themselves or others, and if the services that they required were not available in their community, which is part of the key question that we'll be talking about. This slide, although it looks a bit complicated, it's not. The top line indicates the census trend overall, the total census of the state hospital since January 2010, so a five-year period. The next line, orange colored, is the guilty except for insanity population, which has noticeably decreased. 5 years ago, the average number of guilty except for insanity patients in the state hospital was 339, and today it's 236. These are the people who are under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, PSRB, or the State Hospital Review Panel. And that is a remarkable decrease over a five-year period. There are many more guilty except for insanity people living in the community under PSRB jurisdiction than there are living in the state hospital. The next line down is the civilly committed, involuntary civil commitment patients. And this line is a pretty flat line. If you'll notice, it increases early or late in 2013, early 2014, which simply reflects the closure of the Blue Mountain Recovery Center in Pendleton, which resulted in an increase of population at the State Hospital in Oregon. At the time Blue Mountain was closing, we had two empty units at the State Hospital in Salem, and basically we absorbed the Blue Mountain population into Salem, our Salem facility. Then the bottom line is the population we're talking about, the aid and assist population, which has nearly doubled in the five-year period, been a steady increase from 90, average census of 90 in 2010, now at 152, average census in 2015. This slide talks about the number of total admissions to the state hospital in the period of it's about a two-year period. We've admitted to the state hospital a total of 1,647 patients. 950 of them, or nearly 60% of them, are people admitted under the 370 statute. 41% of them are people who were arrested for a misdemeanor, A, B, or C misdemeanor. So when you do the math, actually combining those numbers, 25% of all patients admitted to Oregon State Hospital are 370 patients charged with a misdemeanor. This slide demonstrates the length of stay for the aid and assist patients with misdemeanor charges only. And I should clarify that when we describe this population, the misdemeanor charge is the highest charge, so we don't mix in. If someone was arrested for a felony but also had a misdemeanor charge, they are excluded from this information. These are people just with misdemeanor charges. So the average length of stay for someone who comes to the state hospital with a misdemeanor charge is 105 0.8 days, 106 days, and the cost of care per day for this population is $806 a day. So the cost for a person who stays the average length of time, the total cost for this hospital stay is $85,000. The median, 50% above, 50% below, is 72 days, and so the cost per patient comes to $58,000 per patient per incident of hospitalization. So that's the bad news. That's the statement of the problem. The people who will come up and speak after me from Marion County will describe what we've seen as a successful intervention into the problem, which I personally think presents an opportunity for resolution of the problem with the misdemeanor charges. We formed a work group about a year ago, brought together the people represented on the slide, I think all the relevant stakeholders, community mental health providers, district attorneys, public defenders, the sheriff's office, people from the county jail, municipal and circuit court judges, Disability Rights Oregon, crisis service providers, people from the Oregon State Hospital, and people from Addictions and Mental Health. And they spent a good deal of time analyzing the problem, looking at opportunities for resolution involving mobile crisis teams that are in the county and travel with police officers when someone is reported as a problem with in the community, often resulting as that, I don't want to steal their presentation, but fewer arrests, therefore fewer people in the jails, and an increase in opportunity for provision of treatment in the community. So these are the results so far with the Marion County project. In a nutshell, there's been a decrease of 1.8 people per month as a result of the work of the work group. I thought when we put this slide together, someone might say, well, that really doesn't sound like much. But that's two people a month across a year is 24 fewer patients coming to the state hospital from Marion County on misdemeanor charges. All other counties during the same period have increased the number of 370 patients coming to the hospital by about one patient a month. But again, that's 12 people a year. And so we believe that the interventions that you'll hear about from Marion County are an indicator that there can be an alternative. The provision of services in the community to people who are arrested and need to be restored to competency is one part of it, but also the intervention to avoid the person being arrested in the first place and yet receiving mental health services in the community without going to jail and without coming to the state hospital. Thank you. Any questions?
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sheriff Myers and Anne Marie Branfield? Manfield.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, reintroduce myself. I'm Jason Myers, a Marion County Sheriff, and I will let Anne Marie introduce herself.
I'm Anne Marie Banfield with Marion County Health Department. I am the Program Supervisor for Acute and Forensic Services with the Health Department.
So we're here today to give you an overview of the collaborative situation we have in Marion County around mental illness and our response to people with mental illness in the community. And we're going to kind of cover about a 20-year time span. This is an issue that we have been working together on for about 20 years, and we are pretty happy with some of the results. But I will start with first is very, very collaborative, and for any system to work, such as the system we have, it takes collaboration. It takes the county health director, the sheriff, the district attorney, judges, county commissioners, law enforcement leaders all to lean in on this issue. And so as I go through this presentation, I'm very hopeful that will come out, that we have great collaboration in our county, which is one of the keys to success. So We're going to start off with really the hub of our system, and I'm going to have Anne-Marie talk about this, but this is a psychiatric crisis center, and this is kind of where everything kind of happens in terms of somebody with that's in a mental health crisis and how we access resources.
Thanks. So if you can think of a 3D model, the crisis center would be at the bottom, and we are the longest running continuous 24/7 crisis center in the state. We have staff in the office around the clock. We have we had a director who was very visionary back in 1995 who established this program, and we are very good at living on a shoestring budget and making sure that our services are always available. In about 1998, we created the respite program, and our goal there was to create a flexible and fluid program that we could use in the moment, no matter what time of day, to really assist people in getting out of situations and yet not place them in hospitals or other institutions where once you go into an institution where somebody's telling you when to get up, when to go to sleep, when to take meds, you lose some of your basic living skills. Our goal was to wrap services around them so they could learn those skills in the community and use them the next time they were in crisis. Our respite program has both homes in the community as well as apartments in the community that we can use to be one-on-one with someone, or even most people just need a chance to get away from what's going on, get a good night's rest, and move on. We've been very successful with our respite program, and we do about 800 placements a year. We have a crisis prescriber that was added in about 2000. Presently, we have 24 hours a week that are 28 hours a week that are available for someone to come in, see a crisis prescriber, get on their medications, and we can do that within 3 to 5 days. And we have three different case management programs for people who are falling between the cracks in the system, whether that's in the acute care system, whether it's in the criminal justice system, or through the 370 process.
So in a matter of context of where this is at, the Psychiatric Crisis Center is on the grounds of the Salem Hospital, is open 24 hours a day. It's a drop-in center. People can be transported there and access these resources 24 hours a day. So that was kind of the beginning of our work around mental health. As we continue to see the numbers continue to grow of folks in mental health crisis ending up in our jail and in the criminal justice system, we knew that we needed to add additional resources to help us. And so the next place that we thought would be a logical place is to put clinicians in the jail to work with people once they came into custody. So I'll have Anne-Marie talk a little bit about that program and how it's expanded over time. But again, that was started in about 2006 and has continued to grow in terms of the personnel assigned at the jail.
So we have at this time three positions out at the jail, one qualified mental health professional and one qualified mental health associate who work Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. They provide, the qualified mental health professional provides evaluations, connections to the mental health prescriber at the jail. They provide connection with families, education. They respond to requests for therapy in the jail and work one-on-one with inmates. The qualified mental health associate provides case management. So their job is to help folks who are transitioning back out into the community, reconnect with community resources, their providers, stay on their medication, get appointments in place so that we're doing a soft handoff to the community and reducing recidivism back to the jail system. We have one person who works the jail on weekends, and they work a 10-hour day. One of the main things we do is to go into intake, make sure that we are working with anybody who's probably going to leave quickly. Again, we slide them right over to the crisis center if we can to make sure they're connecting with community resources and services, getting what they need to stop the crisis that's going on, as well as reconnecting them to their outpatient services. We also work in the medical unit to do suicide risk assessments with the nurse staff.
So at the same time we expanded services in the jail, we knew we needed to do something on the front end of the system, and that obviously has to do with our law enforcement officers. So we took an initiative working together with the health department to begin CIT training, crisis intervention training, for our law enforcement officers in Marion County. And we have offered two classes a year since 2006. We have in-house trainers. We follow the 40-hour nationally recognized Memphis model. To date, so priority for me is to send everybody in my office, so it's not just patrol. All corrections deputies and all community corrections deputies attend. And to date, about 70% of my staff is trained. We open this countywide, so all law enforcement agencies in the county can go. We have people from mental health that go. We open it actually beyond the borders of our county. We have Yamhill County, and we've had officers as far away as LeGrand attend that training. We'll continue that training in the future, and it's really aimed at identifying when somebody is in a mental health crisis and teaching law enforcement officers how to de-escalate and then refer individuals off to supportive services, and hopefully not arrest, depending on the nature of the call. So it's been a very successful program, and we continue to offer that training and will be in the foreseeable future. What we like to do is build out on that training. So we have the 40 hours that we give, and our next phase is to do an enhanced CIT for those that have attended the 40-hour training. The next piece I'll talk about a little bit, and this really ties with the discussion you just had around the state hospital, is our 370 Aid and Assist Case Manager. So I'll let Anne-Marie talk a little bit about that program.
In the recognition of the numbers that were increasing at the state hospital of 370, the state identified a few counties that had high populations. Marion County, although we don't have, I think we're fifth or sixth in terms of population in the county or in the state, we do have seven institutions here in Marion County, which means we have a very high population of persons who need services. When someone goes into one of those institutions, they have to come out with no benefits. And so we have a large number of folks who come into our crisis center from those institutions looking for benefits. So what we found is that we had a very high population at the state hospital under 370. When we first started the case management in 2008, we saw that number come down. But as more and more education happened within the criminal justice system, we saw more and more folks going on that 370 list. So at one point, we had our numbers down under 10. And then last fall, we were back up to 28, which was higher than the original 18. Our goal is to stay under 14, which we are in the last 2 months. We've been at 16. So we're very close, and we're very excited about that.
In the same time frame, we, through the leadership in our county and the district, our district attorney, Walt Begelow, we added a mental health court, which is another resource that folks in mental illness at, or mental health crisis can be referred to. And it's a supportive court program that really aims at restoration in the community.
And our 370 case manager is both a part of mental health court as well as following anyone from the jail who goes to the state hospital on the 370 order. They'll follow them to the hospital and back and monitor their progress and offer services in the community.
So in 2009 through 2012, we knew we needed to do more because we had been doing surveys at our jail to kind of track what is bringing people into custody. And we were doing them on two-year intervals. And our percentage of folks that self-reported having a mental health condition or a mental health crisis, was the percentage was really kind of remaining the same. And we knew we needed to kind of really work on the front end of the system and really focus on diversion. So at that time, we established a mental health task force where we, as the sheriff's office, pulled all of our law enforcement agencies in to take a look at what we could do to better utilize the systems we now had in place. One of the things that came out of those conversations with law enforcement executives was a memorandum of understanding that all law enforcement signed that when they came into contact with somebody in crisis, that they would look at the psychiatric crisis center as a resource and an opportunity to take people there instead of the jail, depending on the nature of the call or the nature of the investigation that they were conducting. So we upped the priority of that. And really asked that they put that in the front of their law enforcement officials' minds when they were out in the community. The other piece is we applied for a COPS grant because we wanted to do some proactive work. And so we received a COPS grant. And in that COPS grant, we took a deputy sheriff, and the Salem Police Chief, Jerry Moore, provided us with a Salem police officer. So again, this is where the collaboration comes together. And we paired the deputy sheriff and the police officer up with a clinician, qualified mental health professional, to go out in the community and make contacts with folks that had been referred to our mental health task force based on officer contacts in the field. Now, these were kind of cold calls. These were not in progress crisis calls, but rather follow-ups with people that had mental, shown that they were in mental health crisis, but not to the level that they needed to go to PCC or to jail. And so that's kind of where we started our kind of front end of the system, one by the MOU, the other by these follow-ups. And we started getting some really amazing stories, and we'll talk about them in a few minutes, but we were making contact with individuals that, in one case, somebody that had called 911 in excess of 100 times in 1 year. And by engaging with that individual, we were able to refer them to services and diminish those 911 calls to like less than 10 in the second year. So we were seeing some good outcomes and positive outcomes and really our emphasis to keep people out of custody and utilizing those precious public safety resources. So that program turned out to be really good and really was being helpful to our system. At the same time, we received some money for some A&D mentors, some mentors to help people through this system, because what we found is it's very, very difficult to navigate the system. Even if you don't have a mental health crisis, it's like the when you get a toy that you need to put together for your child and it's got like six different languages that, you know, the instructions are in. That's the same way our system is. There's so many handoffs and tie-offs, and so we knew that if we had mentors and specially trained law enforcement and clinicians working together, they could help people navigate through the system and access services. Do you want to touch on anything there?
I think it's important to know that when you're talking about crisis services, we have 60 to 70% of the folks that are coming in our door have are co-occurring for some sort of mental health distress as well as a drug or alcohol issue at the same time. What we found with the A&D mentors is that we reduced recidivism. The mentors were great. They will go out in the community. They will engage. Even if the person tries to disengage with us, they will go out and encourage them and really help them tie to community services. It really reduced the number of people who were, again, recycling through the system.
So we kind of got this backwards, but it worked out good because a lot of agencies are going back to the cold calls. They start with mobile crisis and go backwards. We started with the cold calls first, and then we went to mobile crisis. And with the money that was appropriated in the 2013 session, there were grants that were made available through OHA. We applied for those grants, and that's when we created our mobile crisis team. So we were really poised. We were really moving in that direction. That's where we wanted to go. And fortunately, through the work of the legislature and many of you here, that was made available through this funding. And so we launched our mobile crisis in 2014. Took us a little time to get it up and running. Our mobile crisis has two teams. We have a Salem police officer and a deputy sheriff, both who are teamed with clinicians. And they work peak hours, mainly evening hours, 7 days a week coverage. They respond to anywhere in the county where there's a mobile, where there's a mental health crisis. And we've had some phenomenal outcomes. We're going to talk about some data in a few minutes, but their engagement has really really help people in a time of need, which is A, the most important thing, but it's also diverted a lot of folks from the criminal justice system. It's not just the jail. We'll be talking about the overall system impacts of mobile crisis and all the other initiatives that we've put together. I think one of the things I remind people, though, is we've kind of through trial and error, matching up a cop with a clinician, that is a
art. It's a trick.
Yeah, it's a real trick trying to find the boat. I think we've arrived there.
10 hours in a car with people whose personalities aren't in sync or who don't have the same mind frame is an interminable amount of time if it's not going well. So fit is a very important thing.
I don't like committees.
I don't have to sit on those usually.
So you can see all of our pieces kind of tie together. They all function individually, but they all kind of come together. We're going to talk just real quickly about some success stories, and I'm going to let Anne-Marie talk about Michael.
Michael is one that, although engaged in many services in the community, was using 911 services for transportation. As you may or may not know, Marion County has very limited transportation services. And there was a lot of other times where he was dealing with fearfulness and real concerns about safety and had a lot of paranoia with his neighbors. He was very well known to our local law enforcement, both the Sheriff's Office as well as the Salem Police Department. Upon engagement, we got releases, and that is one thing I must say. Our court team does outreach. They get the door open 95% of the time. People are more than happy to get help, and they also will sign releases so that we can all speak to each other, which is one of the outcomes of HIPAA. And so they got the release signed. They started working with his local provider. The sheriff's office were very creative. They were able to find a bicycle to assist him with transportation, which was one of his number one causes. One of the nice things about this team and this collaboration is we're able to think outside the box and really take away the barriers to people getting the services they need. And as you can see, his calls have been decreasing rapidly. We were kind of expecting those to go up in 2014 as the deputy that he had been working with for several years retired. We expected him to see a bump up, to have to struggle with that transition, but actually it has gone very well, and we are very pleased that we are down to just 3 calls a year.
So this situation was one we call Frank. Was a veteran with PTSD and substance abuse issues. Basically, we got a call of a motor vehicle crash into the ditch. When our first deputy arrived, he found that the person was hiding in the bushes, and it was likely that wasn't going to come out. I think, fortunately, our deputy on the scene realized that this was somebody in mental health crisis, called our mobile crisis team, which responded. They began a conversation with an individual, got them to de-escalate, and we got them this person to the hospital to get them help. The good news in this is that sometimes these have really bad outcomes, and it's not because the police want bad outcomes. It's certainly not our desire, but the training and such, that ultimately what this could have been is a situation where somebody was arrested or, worse yet, force used, and in this case it wasn't, and we had a very good outcome with the person going to the hospital and getting the help they need. I'll let Anne-Marie talk about this aid and assist.
We have several clients that recycle through the program, and this person had several aid and assist evaluations over a short period of time. And what we were able to do with by using our mobile crisis resources as well as our diversion case manager and our services at PCC was, as they were having contact at that front end with the officer, we were able to get our mobile crisis teams in and have them take them to the ER instead of to the jail, where we were able to do evaluations two times they were placed in the acute care admissions instead of the jail. This is really where they're going to get much more treatment. The jail does not offer treatment. And they were able to get treatment. They were able to stabilize. They were committed at one point, but they did not go to the state hospital because they were able to restore and stabilize before the state hospital had a bed. And they are in our community and doing well. And this is a reduction of, I believe they'd had... 10 trips to OSH in like the 2 to 3 year period prior to getting involved with our collaborative efforts. I would just say one more thing. We didn't talk very much about the jail diversion case manager. This is the hub of all these collaborations. Every one of the jail, the court team, and the mobile crisis teams can refer to this case manager. They will also go into the jail and connect with anyone that our mental health staff in the jail note are needing services. And they have done a nice job. They work with about anywhere from 25 to 40 people at a time, helping them to move away from that criminal justice system and reconnecting with community resources.
So... we're going to end with just really the proof is in the pudding, right? What are the results here? And we've had some really fantastic results. One that I'm very excited about. One of the ways we kind of take a look at is jail bookings. And in 2009 or 2006, we were kind of in the height of our mental health people with mental health conditions coming into our jail. We were at nearly 20,000 bookings, and since that time, you can see that they've gone down. And we're down about 5,000 in terms of bookings at the jail, which is really good news because usually that's a pie chart that continues to increase, not decrease. Crisis outreach response team. So in the first year, this is actually the team that follows up on the low-level calls that we received. So they received roughly 2,300 reports from law enforcement in the county. And we did about almost 1,000 follow-ups on those. So they really triage these reports really closely and make sure that with the very limited resources that we go after those that we can have the greatest impact. So as you can see, we make it out to about 50% of those. A lot of those may end in arrest, where we may not necessarily follow up on. Mobile crisis, this is where we've had about 450 calls over the year. And what's amazing about that is these are pretty intense calls that they're going to. There was only 22 individuals taken to jail, and 50% of those, 11 of those, had warrants. So only 10 or 11 of those were new charges. So we did a really good job of diverting those folks out of the criminal justice system. And oftentimes they'd end up at PCC, where we have supported services and we can get them the help that they need.
One of the things that's difficult to show you in data is the partnership that they have with local law enforcement. They probably receive 8 to 10 calls a night asking, what should we do with this person? So not only are we taking the calls, but we're also offering collaboration and consultation to the law enforcement as they're encountering others in the community.
So at the end of the day, you know, it's where is this population going? It's going to a good spot, and I think this slide kind of articulates that, is that our crisis evaluations at PCC are up. You can see that there's about a 200 to 300 person increase, which is good. These are people that are, they're not necessarily going to jail. They're not going to the hospital, Salem Hospital, but they're going to PCC where they can get those supported services and wraparound services and case management in those cases that are extreme. Anecdotally, from the Salem Hospital, they do not track police officer custodies, but we're told that those are down, which is good. That means that we're intercepting and getting these people to a place where they can get help, and they're not accessing emergency room beds, which obviously are a concern at the hospital, and they're a concern to us in the community as well. I'll let you talk about the slide.
So we have traditionally had the second largest population at OSH, and although our population is still up there, we have gone from having, I believe last year in November we had 28, and this last year in November we had 18. So we're making a significant progress on reducing the folks who are going to OSH. We have, over the last 5 years, been offering community restoration. The first year we offered 3. Last year we did 12. We hope to see that go up to about 20 this year, and that's where we're offering that skills training right in the community. And the benefit to that, and things that I think is difficult for some folks to understand, is that if we send them to Oregon State Hospital on a 370, they don't receive the same treatment as a civil commitment. So they may or may not go onto medication. They have the right to refuse. They're not going to be coordinating services as they come out. So when somebody, I believe that our criminal justice system is trying to get people to services as quickly as they can, but what they may not understand is once they're released back into the community, the 370 population is either going to stay at jail and go to trial because they've been found able, or they're going to go to, they're going to be released because they've been found never able, and there is no system for them to be tracked. They are voluntary if they choose not to participate in services. There's really nothing we can do. By doing the community restoration, we are connecting them to benefits. We're connecting them to community resources. We're getting them really connected in a good relationship with an outpatient provider, which will translate into stability and less likely to recycle back into the community.
You want to talk about case management?
Our transitional case management has steadily been increasing over the last 4 years by about 50 persons per year. Last year, more than 200 persons were seen, and these, again, are the folks who in the past have just sort of faded into the woodwork and really have not gotten into services or stabilization. Even though we're giving them minimal services, we're helping them to stabilize, get on their benefits, and receive the kind of supports they need to be in the community without getting back into the criminal justice system.
That's it for the information. Be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Sheriff Myers, I thank you for bringing this to us today. This presentation has been fascinating for somebody who's new to this. Just for my own curiosity, you talked a lot about cooperation. You know, Marion County, I don't know how many towns there are in Marion County, but I was just curious. You mentioned Salem Police. Have some of the other city police departments, are they cooperating in this program, and maybe which ones? Because I'm just curious, perhaps Kaiser, since that's somebody I represent.
Yeah, Chair Barker, Representative Post. Yes, the collaboration is fantastic. Now, in terms of working together, 100% all of our agencies, we have this memorandum of understanding. This resource is open to Kaiser. In terms of them placing somebody on our team, we're not there yet. Okay. But you know, it's difficult for the smaller agencies to be able to foster up a position. So, but the working relationship is fantastic. They participate in CIT training, so they do everything that, and we appreciate their help.
Good. Thank you.
I would also add that Staten is 100% trained in crisis intervention training, which is very impressive.
Awesome.
That's good.
You're a very impressive program. Thank you very much
Thank
for all
you.
The work you're doing. Close the informational hearing on community-based mental health options and open a public hearing on House Bill 2382.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2382 comes to this committee from the Office of the Attorney General. The bill establishes a court procedure for criminal defendants who lack capacity to proceed in a probation violation proceeding. and authorizes the court to order evaluations, treatment, and commitment of the defendant in order to gain capacity in probation violation hearings. The proposed Dash 2 amendment would authorize commitment to the state hospital only in probation violations that result from a downward departure or optional probation from a prison sentence. There is no revenue impact, and we don't yet have a fiscal.
Okay, Aaron Knott and Walt Bakelet, please.
Walt's going.
Oh, Walt, okay. You're on your own.
Got it. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice here in support of House Bill 2382, which is a pretty direct offshoot from the presentation that you just heard. It implicates all the same issues. So the ability to go to the state hospital to be restored to capacity to assist your attorney in your defense stops. And under existing law at the point that you're convicted. That means once you go into probation, under current law, you no longer have the right to be sent to the state hospital if you come in on a probation violation. Now, the caveat that I would put on that is if your violation is that you've picked up a new crime, that is the justification to send you to the state hospital. But there's still a significant population of probationers that have mental health issues that flare up during their probation violations, and they become unable to aid and assist. So what House Bill 2382 aims to do is try to figure out what to do with that population. And the way it's written originally is not a very elegant solution. It basically just says the state hospital will take all probation violations. That's extremely expensive, and it doesn't draw any distinctions between levels of crime seriousness. So you're talking about people that are on probation for very serious, what I would call presumptive prison cases, and I'll talk more about that in a minute, all the way down to low-level misdemeanors. But what I was hoping would happen with House Bill 2382 did in fact happen, which is it provided the forum for stakeholders to come together and start having a conversation about how you balance the expense of sending somebody to the state hospital and the recognition that that really should be an instrument of last resort with the need to make sure that some of these cases are addressed. So there are, and this is a generalization, but generally speaking, there are three different types of criminal sentences you can get. There are sentences where you know you will never go to prison, misdemeanors and low-level felonies, and there are cases where you must go to prison. Your mandatory minimum cases, ballot measure 11 cases, usually very serious person crimes. Now, in the middle, there's a third category, and this is the category that our conversation as a stakeholder group and the Dash 2 amendments is concerned with. And these are called dispositional departures, and I want to give you an example of what that is. So you have someone, say, come in on burglaries, and they've done one or two of them before. So their presumptive sentence is prison. But you have an evaluation that says that this person is schizophrenic, that their schizophrenia may have contributed to their criminal action, that they've been treated successfully in the past, and that they would be eligible for a downward departure if the court thinks that that is an acceptable thing to do. Part of why we're so concerned with that population is what I've just described are judicially recognized bases for giving somebody less than a presumptive or prison sentence. One would be they have mental illness. The other one would be there's treatment in the community. But, and this is alarming for me as a former prosecutor, if you can't treat somebody who is suffering from a severe mental illness, meaning they come in on a probation violation and you can't send them to the state hospital, I'm concerned that you will not give them a downward departure in the first place out of fear that you cannot really supervise them in the instance that their mental health condition flares up. And that's a dangerous disincentive that I think at the very least this bill needs to address and does address via the Dash 2s. The only reason that we're not asking you more specifically to consider the Dash 2s today is because they just came back and this is a large group. This is DOJ, DRO, ODAA, the sheriffs, the defense attorneys, community corrections, and OHA. So we need to put some more work in on this. But I think we're very close to being able to ask you to move a bill. But the other part that needs to plug in here is the next bill you're going to hear relates to this one. It's 2420, and I bring it up here only because what it is about is trying to treat more people in the community. And the way it's written now, the people we're treating in the community are people that are facing pending charges. But for our probation violations, in fact, for everyone that we send to the state hospital, we need to look to community resources first. And so my hope is that 2382 can be made to plug into that. If you're not violent, if you're not a dangerous offender, you heard testimony earlier that if you're not dangerous, that's a factor that militates against you going to the state hospital, and you're facing a probation violation, that too should be treated in the community whenever possible. We know that community treatment maintains your connections to your family, it maintains your connections to your job, to your home, and to any existing care that you have. It is almost always the best option unless there is a compelling public safety or clinical reason not to treat somebody in the community. So with that, I'm open for any questions you have on this bill. Thank you.
So the Dash 2 is not ready to go?
We've just had today to look at it. Committee Council's done a great job turning it around quickly, but it just came back, this morning, I think. Thank you.
Is there any questions, committee? Okay, thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2382. And open the public hearing on House Bill 2420.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2420 comes to this committee from the Office of the Governor. It requires a community mental health director or their designee to interview criminal defendants who lack capacity to proceed in a criminal case if the offense is a C felony or a misdemeanor. The bill requires community mental health to prepare findings for the court about whether restorative services are available in the community. The proposed Dash 1 amendment provides some clarifying language and expands that interview requirement to all criminal proceedings. There is no revenue impact. We do have a fiscal impact.
Okay, Stacy Michelson, Michael Morris, and Lisa Nato. Please.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Michael Morris, and I am the Behavioral Health Policy Administrator with the Addictions and Mental Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. And so I won't go into the problem. You've heard enough about the problem and the issue that we're having with individuals having to go to the state hospital for aid and assist restoration services. Also in Greg Roberts' presentation, he talked about that there was some changes in the statute, House Bill 3100, that enabled the court to order community restoration if there were services available and the person that was not a danger to self or others. And what we have found is that with even that change is that even with those counties that had services like here in Marion County for community restoration services, oftentimes individuals would end up at the state hospital without the community mental health program even knowing that the person went to the state hospital. And in the work that we did with Marion County in that group is discovered that the biggest issue was communication with the court and with those involved in the case to assess whether there are those services available in the community to provide those restoration services. So this bill would require that the courts have the community mental health program director or the designee interview the individual, the defendant, and determine if, given the person's situation psychiatrically, that whether there are the services and supports necessary in the community to provide that restoration in the community. And the current version of the bill is that it is for those defendants that have been charged with their highest crime of a Class C felony or a misdemeanor. So just also, and I'll address the Dash 1 amendments in just a second here, but I also want to inform you that there is included in the governor's budget $4 million to target the four highest communities that are referring individuals to the state hospital to provide other services and supports to increase the number of restorations in the community. In talking with Marion County, for example, they do have some funds for services, but they also need some additional funds, for example, for housing and also to address alcohol and drug issues, which are oftentimes involved in these situations. So there is that companion funding in the governor's recommended budget that you ought to know about that as far as the, you know, if we're looking at increasing those restoration services in the community, there is some funding to support that. Just to let you know, the four counties with the highest number of referrals, if we address the number of referrals to the state hospital with those counties, we would be addressing about 60% of the issue. In regards to the Dash 1 amendments, we've been part of the work group that was referenced earlier, and two tweaks to that, this bill and the Dash 1 amendments are, one, the changing of the term interview to the term consult with, and that just better clarifies what the intent of that process goes. And then the members of that work group were really supportive that it was important not just for the Class C individuals who had committed Class C felons or misdemeanors, but this linking individuals up to community mental health services was important for the wide range of defendants and not just those. And so the Dash 1 amendments removes that condition that it be a Class C felony or misdemeanor. Also, we just have found out that there are some concerns regarding the present bill in the sense some concerns from the courts regarding that this process may actually cause a second hearing to have to take place or for delays in the disposition of the situation. So we have been working even this afternoon with stakeholders to determine how to tweak the language to enable this process to happen without it causing further hearings or causing delays for individuals. And I'm available for any questions.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a brief question?
Please.
For the aid and assist for a Class C felony, would that require locked resources? Or?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, not necessarily would they require. And that's one of the purposes of the evaluation is to determine not just are services available for restoration, but are the necessary supports to safely treat that individual in the community is available.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Any
further? Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Stacey Michelson, policy manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. Thank you for the time today. We're here to speak in support of House Bill 2420. I don't need to repeat a lot of what you've already heard today. As Mike said, we've heard a lot about the issues that exist. We'll just provide quickly from the county perspective. As most of you know, our counties are the local mental health authority statutorily, and so our members take that role very seriously and take very seriously their responsibility to provide services in the community. So for us, this is a great bill to ensure before folks are going to the state hospital that capacity assessment is being done at the local level. You know, it's very clear from the mental health field that community-based services, when possible, are the best place to treat folks. You know, you're closer to family support network. You know, beyond that, it's costly to send folks to the state hospital, particularly if it's simply for an evaluation. You know, we're sending someone from Harney County over to Salem to get evaluated. I think the first question there is, you know, do we have the services at the local level to be evaluating and treating that person if needed? So both from a service provision standpoint and an efficiency standpoint, AOC is very supportive of this bill and excited to see the POP that's attached with it. I think, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't mention we would, you know, like to see additional funds for more of our counties to bolster those services, but we are supportive of the bill as is. So thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Nato.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Lisa Nato, and I'm speaking here today just on behalf of myself and my family. I support HB 2420, but most importantly, I support the funding that goes with it, or should go with it, to provide these services in the community. Many of you know I'm a former, I'm an attorney now still, but I'm a former, and I'm a little nervous because this is talking about my private life, which I don't normally do. I'm an attorney, former deputy district attorney in Multnomah County, former state legislator, former county commissioner, where I focused a lot of my work on the intersection of mental illness and the correction system. I chaired the Association of Oregon Counties Public Safety Committee and also the National Association of Counties Public Safety Committee and looked at a number of these issues that you are also struggling with. We're not alone in this country about how we treat people with mental illness. I have a brother, I have four brothers actually, and the majority of my siblings are all PhDs, so we come from a pretty high-achieving family. But this one brother in his youth developed very severe and it's persistent schizophrenia, and he's been disabled because of that. He lives in a trailer here in Oregon, in Washington County, and this is all public record, so I'm not releasing anything that's private. Several years ago, about 4 years ago, on a December 23rd, he was in a Fred Meyer and put a sandwich and several flashlights into a backpack. He is the kind of person who would be watched. He's overweight. He's pretty much unkempt most of the time. And he was stopped by the security guard. He wasn't a model citizen. He yelled some profanities. I don't want to sugarcoat everything. But the result is he dropped the backpack, fled on his bicycle, and in his backpack there was a letter with his address on it. So later the police caught up with him on his bike and told him to stop. They would have no way of knowing he doesn't have brakes on the bicycle. And eventually they had to do a takedown. They wrote in the police report that he lifted his arm. Therefore, he was charged with both a resisting arrest and a shoplift charge of theft, too. I'll digress a little. This whole thing has a lot of iterations. I'm going to try to keep it narrow to be focused on this issue because there were a lot of other parallel things that happened with this case. But it was right before Christmas. He generally spent Christmas Eve with our family, and he always had some kind of gift, and I just assume that he was shoplifting those flashlights for presents. And I just say that's my opinion, and also at the end of the month, he usually runs out of money, and we weren't aware of that, and he was probably hungry, and therefore the food. It's not to say this was right. I totally think it was wrong. At that point, then, he was arraigned, and other things happened, but he was appointed a court-appointed attorney. And my brother is fully aware of the mental health system. He's been involved with it before. At that time, I'd been working with the legislature on the indeterminate kind of sentences that you can get in custody for mental illness, whereas you might have a known sentence for a minor crime. He was aware of that. But because he was charged with a resisting arrest, and he didn't want to take an evaluation, his attorney called me and said, I want to have him evaluated for the sole purpose of determining if he formed the intent to resist arrest. And I thought, well, that seems reasonable to me. And so I regret now, but I did help call and convince him to have an evaluation. Another brother took him to the evaluation. He was very disheveled. He was probably thinking it was to his advantage to be really honest about all of the symptoms of his mental health. And I can go into some of the details, which I found out later about the evaluation. But long story short, I was shocked when the attorney called me back and said my brother had been found unable to aid and assist. I was shocked. We went to court. My siblings, we all wrote letters to the judge saying he lived on his own with some supports. He was not a danger to the community. Could we please get a second opinion? Because we had thought he had gone into that evaluation unprepared. Also, they had asked. We found out later they had asked about elements of the crime and the resist. So the whole thing was just like a Kafka experience. The judge did find that there should be another evaluation. And several months later, I took him on, and he was outpatient this whole time. I took him to the state hospital for a second evaluation. He completed that. A couple months passed. We had another hearing. We did not see the evaluation. We had never seen the first evaluation. And minutes before going into the hearing, the attorney came to us and said, we have the report. They recommend he's unable to aid and assist. We were never able to see the report. We went into the courtroom. We asked the judge, could we provide get services local in the community so he'd be able to be treated there? And the judge, who was very sympathetic, said simply there were none available, and therefore he had to go into the state hospital. And at that point, my brother cried, help me, and collapsed. I went to try to help him and talk to him, but the judge ordered the courtroom cleared. And of course, at that point, we were worried about his safety and in the state hospital. At that point, I called my ex-husband, who's an attorney, doesn't do criminal work, but he is a really good guy, and my brother knows him, as one of the elements are being able to trust your attorney. Representative Barton knows my ex-husband very well. So my ex-husband, Steve, got involved, and he ordered all the court records, and we learned that actually the attorney had, his court-appointed attorney had, in fact, asked for an aid and assist evaluation, where he had been asked about elements of the crime, he had gone to this evaluation. We hadn't told him to take a shower and get cleaned up and look good, or, you know, we hadn't prepped him at all for it. She was not present at it, so he made self-incriminating remarks. And we had never been given a copy of the evaluation, and I didn't even know, and I should have known as an attorney, that the judge had a copy of the evaluation, all the questions asked, the defense attorney had a copy of all the questions, and the district attorney had a, and you were talking about a person who's paranoid about the system conspiring against him. And he was not given a copy of any of the reports. And when he said he didn't trust his court-appointed attorney, of course, that worked against him too. So it was really this incredible setup. Long story short, he went to the state hospital. My ex-husband Steve got involved, filed a motion to try to substitute as an attorney. The judge determined that since my brother was unable to aid and assist, he could not be substituted as an attorney. I ended up filing a bar complaint because I really felt that the attorney had violated attorney-client privilege, had misrepresented to me, basically lied to me, and then proceeded to work with the state hospital. He was treated well, although there was at one point his roommate had attacked him, and then they put him into his own room. About a week before his evaluation, when he'd been in the state hospital for 2 months, I was visiting him, which is a hardship for some people who don't have flexible jobs like me or don't have money to drive to the state hospital and let him know that people out there care about him. And I asked him, what are you going to say about your attorney? And he goes, well, if I say I don't like her, they'll use that against me. And I thought, well, you've kind of figured this out. Then they called. He was released then after that evaluation, as they determined he was able to aid and assist. And I had actually informed them about the misrepresentations the attorney had made to me. They transported him to the jail in Clackamas County and called my ex-husband Steve, who we had now gotten on as his civil attorney. And although we've never filed any suits or anything. And he told his court-appointed attorney he was coming in. That morning then, he was brought in his jumpsuit and the chains, and he was able to substitute Steve as the attorney. He pled guilty, or no contest, to the shoplifting charge and was put on probation for 2 years with credit for time served. And he paid back the $7 for the sandwich that was taken. The state probably paid over $50,000, $60,000, maybe $100,000 for this, with 2 months in the state hospital, all the evaluations and everything else. And the epilogue for me has been, one, nobody asked me upon his release where he was going to live when he got out. If our family had not continued paying the rent on his trailer, he would have had no place to live. And most people don't have a family. I was told by someone in the state hospital that most of their patients, they have no family members and support. During this time, his Social Security check he hadn't been taking any money out, and I think they assumed he was dead. So it had stopped, so I had to take him, spend about a half a day to the Social Security office. They wouldn't let me take care of anything we have to bring him, show him proof, and get that all signed up again so he had money to live on. Once I saw the evaluation forms, I saw that the state itself, in their evaluation, while they said he was not able to aid and assist, they recommended that he not come to the state hospital because paranoid schizophrenics generally can get worse when they're put into situations of institutions, which they distrust. So in all, there's a lot of more detail I could go into, but it was a Kafkaesque experience that could have all been avoided if there had, and he's a nonviolent person, if there had just been community services to allow, to treat him for the aid and assist. He would have been able to stay in his home. We would have been able to continue our support for him. This it actually is a good story because he's now the same as he was. He's living where he was. He has the same life back. But it could have been a disaster. We were worried that he would possibly never get out of the state hospital, that he might be hurt by someone in the state hospital. So I beg you, I urge you to do everything you can to provide these community supports. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your
what I find out, you know, Mr. Chair, what I find in what interests me with what Lisa's describing initially, that was only a third-degree misdemeanor. I mean, just a misdemeanor, third-degree theft. I mean, so it's kind of interesting.
Okay, thank you very much, Aaron. And Aaron Knott, do you want to testify on this?
Chair Barton, members of the committee, Aaron Knott here again.
Standing between us and
yeah, legislative director for the Attorney General and the Department of Justice. And I think it's pretty much redundant to testify at this point. The conclusion is the one you just heard. This bill takes a step in keeping that from happening again. And while it might be callous to bring up money as well, it also prevents the money from being spent. It's a point that deserves emphasis here. Yeah, the state hospital is a measure of last resort, and it's expensive for that reason. And the community is almost always cheaper. So on multiple levels, this is the right thing to do. Enjoy your evening.
Since it's time, nobody's asking any questions.
I have 13 more questions.
I have a lot of questions.
13 more questions.
I have a lot of questions.